Hello, this is Meet the Writers. I'm Georgina Godwin. Well, I have two guests today and they have a rather unique story. One of them is a filmmaker who was jailed for tax fraud, an event which has inspired an eye-opening book about the experience entitled A Bit of a Stretch. His former partner and mother of his child has also used some of his memories to inform her latest novel, Brixton Hill. The books look at the subject of prison from both a fictional and a non-fiction perspective. Chris Atkins and Lottie Muggar, welcome to Meet the Writers. Chris, let's start with you. Give us a bit of background. You're a filmmaker.
Yes, I still am, I suppose. I'd worked in the film industry throughout sort of the 2000s, making fiction films and feature documentaries. And there was a culture at the time of, the simplest way of putting it is very rich celebrities and bankers avoiding tax by sort of channeling it through film production schemes. And people may have read about this, people like sort of Jimmy Carr and various footballers loan their tax bills by putting money into film, and we would get some of the money to make the film. That was the deal. But as the sort of the decade went on, the system kind of got out of hand, and some certain schemes, including one I was involved with, started crossing that invisible line really between legal tax avoidance and illegal tax evasion. And the scheme that we were involved in basically got progressively more bent, and you know, we ended up getting prosecuted for using that scheme to fund our film. It got 5 years, nearly 5 years ago, actually. It was in July 2016.
But Chris, I mean, for you, you didn't at the time think that you were really doing anything criminal.
Well, you put such an odd spin on things with the benefit of hindsight, don't you? I was aware we were doing something probably that was a bit naughty, and it's no excuse, but everyone else was doing it. I didn't really think it was that criminal, but given my documentaries hold the rich and powerful sort of account for dishonesty and wrongdoing, I can't really put my hands up and say, you know, we were totally blind to it. So, you know, I shouldn't have done it and should have known better, I think is a fair way of putting it.
Yeah. Well, Lottie, I'd like to bring you in now because you come from a hugely respected literary family. Your mother's the wonderful Deborah Muggar, and your grandmother, also a writer, was once incarcerated. Tell us a little about that.
Her story was very dramatic. It was she was done for murder, actually. She helped a elderly friend of hers commit suicide, a friend who was very much, you know, she was in part of a euthanasia group, and she asked my granny to help her if her own attempt at ending her life wasn't successful, and my granny did, and told someone who told the police. And yes, it was a bit of a It was quite a big story at the time because she was quite old for a start, and she was a sort of good Christian lady, and yes, it was quite a big deal. But she didn't get nearly as long as Chris did, actually, for for tax fraud.
I should have killed someone, yeah.
But I mean, Chris, like Lottie's grandmother, you're not the typical prisoner. It must have been, was it profoundly shocking for you to find yourself suddenly on trial?
Oh, God, yeah. And you know, in his death by a thousand cuts with tax, in the sense that it was, I mean, Lottie will remember this, but it was 4.5 years between me first being arrested and then being convicted. So it dragged on and on and on and on. So I remember saying to Lottie shortly before the trial, I was like, God, let's just get this over and done with. I can't bear the uncertainty anymore. And that was actually the worst thing, was the waiting. The trial itself was only a month, but it was 4.5 years of with the sword of Damocles hanging over you.
And that must have been incredibly stressful. I mean, you two have a child together, but presumably, was this the factor that drove your breakup?
Oh, no, that was, no, it wasn't.
Well before, but, yeah.
Yeah, it was well before, so no, it wasn't. And actually, I feel I'm very pleased that we weren't together when Chris went to prison, because I think it made it, you know, very complicated relationship between men inside, their partners outside with children. It can get very messy. I think Chris can agree with it.
Ours were completely
ours, and so ours was a much cleaner and a cleaner arrangement, in that I didn't feel I wasn't emotionally reliant on Chris, I wasn't financially reliant on him. Like, I'm very pleased for Kit's sake that
totally.
It was unmessy.
Kit is your son. And of course, you were still involved, though, and reading Chris's wonderful book, A Bit of a Stretch, you get the sense that you were very much part of it, though, Lottie. You were very much a kind of support system on the outside, and of course, bringing Kit in to visit him.
Yeah, yes. We visited, I mean, as much as we could, which was at the beginning wasn't very much because it took months for Kit to be allowed in. They had to do all these security checks on him. But then once we were in the system, we came every week to Wandsworth.
Yeah, Lottie was absolutely fantastic and brought in. I always say I saw more of my son than other prisoners who were still married saw their kids. Lottie was religiously brought him in every week, which was wonderful. Mm.
There was never any question of Kit not seeing him. I know some people, you know, think it might be better for the children not to see their father in that kind of situation and sort of keep them separate. But no, there was never any doubt that we would be as involved as we possibly could be.
Mm. And I know talking to your mother, she describes, and Chris, we get this from your book too, how she would come and then talking about sort of people queuing up in the canteen and almost all of the visiting time is kind of spent queuing. Mm. And so she would go and help other people in the queue so you could spend time with your son.
Yeah, no, she was, I mean, Debbie was absolutely fantastic. It was almost like a surrogate mother of my own, really, because my own mother was quite ill when I went away. So Debbie was absolutely phenomenal. And visits were very bittersweet, because for me, it was this sort of warm window where I got to see my family again. But you're right, the admin and the bureaucracy of the whole process, this is in Wandsworth, which is quite a high security prison. It kind of seemed to swallow much of people's time and energy. So there wasn't really ever enough time to spend having those precious moments with your family, because you're too busy kind of juggling with the authoritarian bureaucracy of the place.
Mm. Tell me more then about the actual prison experience, because it seems to me that there's very definitely a hierarchy, something that you highlight in your book.
Yeah, and it's not what you'd expect, because and it wasn't certainly what I expected, because my only experience of prison had come from popular culture. So, you know, I'd seen Shawshank Redemption, Porridge, Orange is the New Black. That's what I thought would be a bit like that, and it's not at all. And you're right, there is a hierarchy, but it's not the most violent people or the people who've done the biggest armed robbery or the people who sell the most drugs. It's actually the middle class people who seem to come out on top. Certainly this was in Wandsworth. Because prisons are so underfunded and badly run, they need prisoners. This is the big secret. They need prisoners to keep the place running, or it will literally grind to a halt. And the prisoners that they choose to keep the place running are the middle class people who are all quite educated, have degrees, they've got good communication skills, they can deal with bureaucracy. And crucially, we weren't going to abuse the jobs we were given to, you know, sell drugs or whatever. So the middle class people end up getting all the best jobs, which means they get the best cells and they get out their cells more and get more, you know, access to the senior management and basically get a much better life for themselves. Mm. And I quite quickly fell into that clique. I mean, it's shameful to say, but I did sort of exploit that inequality to make my life a bit less rubbish.
But I mean, all these articles one sees, you know, it's like a holiday camp in there. That's not true, is it?
Not in the slightest. No, it's almost some great sort of right wing tabloid myths, along with, you know, immigrants are all sponges and stuff like that. But no. Absolutely. I mean, if someone was killing themselves every 3 days in Butlins, you could say, okay, it's like Butlins. But unfortunately, that is sort of the suicide statistics that we're looking at. And certainly, when I went to Wandsworth, it had the highest suicide rate in the UK. And when I was there for a few weeks, you could see why, because everyone is just locked in their cells. Most people in that prison are locked in their cells for 23 hours a day, which does terrible, terrible things to the mind and encourages mental health problems, and means you can't call home or you can't get out to exercise and you're just stuck in a cell all day. So that was the grim reality of it, is just endless, endless bang up.
And you trained as a listener, which is someone who helps other prisoners.
Yeah, that was initially it was, I'll be honest, that was for the perks. It was, it's a scheme run by the Samaritans, and it's run in pretty much every jail in the UK, where because the Samaritans can't really do help directly in prison, what they do is they train trusted prisoners to counsel other inmates who are suicidal, self-harming, or just very, very upset for whatever reason. And so any prisoner, if they're feeling suicidal, can press their emergency bell, call to speak to a listener. Someone like me will come along, and you just sit and chat about their problems. You don't offer solutions, you don't offer guidance, you just let them outpour their emotions and problems. And that hopefully makes them feel a bit better and hopefully makes them less likely to kill themselves. Mm. So yeah, I did that for about 6 months.
Lottie Robb, the protagonist in Brixton Hill, seems to me an intrinsically good person. Is he based on Chris? How much of Chris's experiences informed your novel?
Well, the character himself isn't Chris, but I mean, I absolutely couldn't have written the book without Chris, in that the details of his so everyday life in prison would be impossible to, I mean, you know, it's a very closed, opaque world, prison. And if you're trying to find out really the tiny details that kind of give flavour to the day there, then you can't really Google it, and you can't really, I mean, some people have written books about it, but they often, the stuff you want to know isn't in those books, like how much you get to spend on the canteen, you know, the sort of your food that you buy every week, and how much you can spend on there each week, and just the tiny, very specific questions I had. Chris was like, yeah, it was completely indispensable. I actually came up with the idea for the book before Chris went to prison. It was from a visit to Brixton Prison, which I went as part of a sort of history group I'm part of. And they told us during this visit that Brixton used to be an open prison. And I was just quite surprised. I always thought open prisons were in the middle of nowhere, and to have one right in the middle of London, and to have all these people wandering around who would, you know, go back to the prison at night, but during the day have this kind of ersatz freedom, that really caught my imagination. But then a year or so later, Chris went inside and I realised that I actually could write it now, this story I have, which I think before, you know, just on my own, I'd been floundering around and I wouldn't have been able to do it.
And I love the way that your book unfolds, because you give us a lot of information, but we have no idea what it all means, really, until quite near the end. I mean, that must have been a fairly intricate plotting right from the beginning. You would have to have known where you were going.
I did. I knew the twist, which in the hope that someone listening might read it, I won't reveal, but the twist about what Rob actually did, that was in my head from the very beginning. So I sort of worked backwards from that. And yeah, it did take a while. It did take a while, but I quite enjoy plotting. My mum is a great plotter and she's a great believer in story. And I've definitely inherited that. I really enjoyed sort of making things, weaving things together. That's the fun bit of writing for me.
And it comes across so well in the book. I mean, one is absolutely gripped by it.
Oh, good.
Chris, a bit of a stretch really addresses what's wrong with the prison system in this country. I mean, you've talked about suicides. What would be your recommendations for penal reform?
I mean, you could write a list of 100 things, or fundamentally it comes down to a couple of things. And one is money, because the coalition government under the austerity measures cut a huge amount of the prison budget. I mean, the whole criminal justice budget as a whole. I mean, if you look at the courts backlog, courts are massively underfunded as well. But the number of people in prison stayed the same. So the amount of money being spent on things that rehabilitate, things that are going to hopefully change people and make them into not criminals, all that got cut. So all the money that's left was just spent on keeping them locked up. And the problem is that you've got to let these people out at some stage, and a huge majority of them walk out and commit crime again, and they reoffend and create new victims. So I would say that the cuts to the prison system were a false economy, because it's not helping reduce crime. It's actually inflaming crime. So it's things like more officers, more education courses, more mental health treatment, you know, some more money spent on that, which you will save because reoffending will go down and we'll have less crime in the future. And then the other thing, really, it's more about public perception and more about how the public and the media and politicians sort of view and engage with prisons. Because you flagged, quite rightly flagged it early on, that there is this sort of myth of the holiday camp that, you know, oh, it's all lags, you know, having a laugh, life of Riley, playing Xbox, eating pizzas and stuff. And there's this sort of weird sadistic mindset that the public has towards prisons, which is if somebody's done something wrong, then they need to be treated as brutally as possible. And the more brutal, the better. It's quite weird. There's very few other countries in the world that have this attitude. Bizarrely, even America has a slightly more progressive approach in lots of prisons. So it's really a tackling that. It's tackling the mindset and a bit more funding, which, as I say, will pay dividends in the long run.
Drugs in prison. Now, both books address this. Chris, what is it, a big problem?
Yeah. Well, it's not a problem getting hold of them, but it's a problem. And then I joke, I never touch them. But the extent that it was just everywhere. And it's interesting how Lottie sort of, it weaves that very cleverly into her plot, because one of the problems with open prison, because I only spent 9 months in Wandsworth, I spent the rest of my time in open prison, and it's like there's a porous skin to open prison, so stuff is flowing in and out all the time. So in Wandsworth, it was spice, which is this synthetic cannabis substance that you can't smell and you can't test for in urine, which means it's very easy to sort of smuggle into closed prisons. But then in open prisons, it's even worse, because people like Rob, the character in Lottie's book, are going in and out of the prison every day. So it's very, very easy for people just to bring stuff back to get to sell to people if it's still inside the prison. So yeah, you could score drugs, any drug really, within about 5 minutes in either prison, really. It was astonishing.
I was going to ask Chris if he was really never tempted to take to try just in the in just out of interest.
Just while we're here. No, not at all, oddly. I also quit smoking when I went in. And I was smoking, if you remember during the trial, I was chain smoking all the whole time. And it was kind of almost like you've been rebooted, is the best way I can describe it. It's like a computer that's been turned off and on again when you go in. It's such a shock to the system. It's actually quite easy to just to change things basically about yourself because you don't feel yourself. I didn't feel like Chris for a long period of time. So it was quite straightforward. And, you know, without giving too much away, when I have enjoyed certain things in the past, it's been in the environment of someone's house or going to a club or a pub or something like that. So the thought of getting high in prison, you know, where you can't go and party and chat to your friends and women and stuff, it is complete anathema. And also the only thing really on offer pretty much in Wandsworth was Spice. And you see people on Spice and they do look like they're about to die, already dead. They're not a great advert for their product. And also I remember somebody a mutual friend of mine, Lottie's, who had also been to prison, said to me, just as I went in, he said, whenever you think of any temptation, whenever you think of doing, crossing the line or mucking about a bit, picture your son in your head. Picture him, because that's the person you're going to be harming by having that spliff or that line or whatever it is. And it's like, I'd already caused so much damage to Kit anyway by going away for 2.5 years, and to Lottie for having to look after him, you know, all that time, to then do more damage over a glass of wine or a line of coke. It was just unconscionable, really. So no, it wasn't that wasn't hard to resist at all.
And how has Kit coped with it all?
Chris, do you want to?
You can start, because you had him on the outside while I was on the inside, so you had a sort of better over that time.
Yeah, I mean, at the time he was just turned 4, and he really was. I mean, he was. His character anyway, he's the kind of boy who just, he does take things at face value and he accepts what you tell him. And so he didn't ask that many questions. At first we said that Daddy was on a timeout. We thought, we tried to put it in language that he would understand. And we said that Daddy was on timeout. He'd done something wrong and he was on a timeout. And he was in a place called The Building, because we thought the prison had such, until Kit sort of had more of a grasp on it, and the prison was so associated in his head with sort of bad people in that, you know, very simple sort of 4-year-old way. I just wanted to for him to have more of an understanding of the situation before we use that word. And, you know, he sort of seemed to be taking it in his stride, and he was fairly, on visits, he was fairly happy, and he didn't ask Chris many questions. He just sort of, they sat on, you know, read Mr. Men books, and it seemed like it was vaguely okay. I would say that since Chris has come out, it's become, and you know, which has obviously coincided with Kit having a, you know, greater sort of grasp on language and being able to articulate his feelings more, that the effects have become more clear now. Would you say, Chris?
Yeah, I mean, I did worry that it would take time to rebuild the bond when I got out, and thanks to, as I say, Lottie's tireless work to bring him in on visits and do phone calls and letters and all that, he kind of clamped onto me the second I got out, really, and didn't really want to leave my side. It almost went the other way.
He's very fearful that Chris is going to go away again.
Yeah, he's very fearful. I mean, he's on headphones next door, but even yesterday, last night, I was reading Treasure Island to him, and we get to the point where Jim goes away and leaves his mum just to go off on this adventure. And it's clearly he survives, because he obviously comes back to write the tale, but Kit got very, very upset. There's a lovely drawing in the book of Treasure Island with Jim saying goodbye to his mum, and she's sort of weeping as he goes away off on his big adventure. And Kit bursts in tears, like, are you going to leave me? Are you going to go away? Are you going to go away? So the smallest of things can sort of trigger this sort of massive separation anxiety, I would say, which is, you know, it's totally understandable. So you've just got to sit and hold the hand and talk them through it.
Yeah, and of course he's featured a lot in your book, and there is a small boy in your book too, Lottie. I wonder how you kind of divvied up the stories, if you like. I mean, there's one story that comes up in both, and it's such a small thing, but I can see how it would absolutely influence the life of a prisoner, is the food and the space that you're given in court, Chris.
Oh yeah, in those holding cells. Yeah, and spilling it on your clothes. Yeah.
I mean, I found that fascinating that everybody who goes back to court has food stains on their clothes.
No, it's astonishing. I think I've still got that. I think I still kept it. And it was just to the extent where I didn't even want to wear it. So I was like, I don't want to. And they're like, no, you've got to have that. You've got to do, that's just what you do because the rules sort of state it. And it was this sort of weird, you know, like you can cut a tree and you see the rings going through it. So it's like as my prison journey went on, these stains became more kind of disgusting and encrusted as a sort of permanent reminder. It's like, that's day one. That's your entry stain. And that's the other stain from when you went back here. Yeah. Because as I say, you're not even given anything to eat off. You've got to eat off your lap. And I'm a pretty messy eater anyway. So, and you're just given this sort of scalding hot plastic tray of a sort of little curry or something, and yeah, half it goes on your clothes.
I do remember though that actually that was one detail because we did sort of I just couldn't resist it. It was so good, and Chris did say like that's in my book, and I think that's the only one. There was one about chicken. Chicken burgers were a great object of like, you know, anyway, they were very much prized when they came on the menu. I think we changed that. There were a couple of things, but basically because my book is based on is sort of looking at the open prison experience, and Chris's is about Wandsworth, which is at the other end of the scale. There wasn't as much crossover as there in terms of the actual sort of fibre of the books as you might expect, actually.
Yeah.
And also one's fiction, one's not. And Lottie's is so much wrapped up in this amazing character of Rob and the sort of the psychology of that. And I would say reading it, you know, my God, she gets inside people's heads well in terms of, you know, what those people are like. But it wasn't, in a sense, it wasn't my head.
No.
Because of our offences, it was so wildly different. Rob's is a much more serious offence. And he's also an indeterminate prisoner, which means he doesn't have a fixed release date. And I did. I knew when I went in, they gave me a piece of paper saying, you are getting out on 28th of December 2018. Look, I can always remember that date. So I knew that from the day I went in. Rob was in a very different, in Lottie's books, in a very different situation because he's an indeterminate prisoner, which means that he doesn't know when he's going to get out. And if he puts one foot wrong, his whole sentence could be extended by years. And there's lots of people like this in the system. And that's a very, very different mindset. It's a deeply more paranoid, anxious, insecure psychology those people have. And Lottie got that absolutely bang on, the sort of the fear they live with.
I mean, I'd really recommend to people that they read the two back to back because it just enhances both. And they're both such wonderful, wonderful books. Chris, reading in prison, did you have access to literature?
Well, I did. Funny enough, before I went away, the night before I went, the morning, Lottie gave me a load of books. Because I was going around to her place a lot to see Kit, because we moved Kit into her flat and we lived very close then. So I was coming back and popping in, you know, on the way to court and so forth. So when I knew I was going away, Lottie, you just gave me about a stack of 20 books going, that'll get you through your first month. I was very, very glad because I didn't have much to do in my first month. And then after that, when people always said, what can I do? What can I do? What can I do? There was very little you can do for someone in prison other than send them books. So I just said, look, whatever book you think I will like, I trust you, send me a book. And people did. So I had this vast library, actually. And as time went on, I got busier and busier. I didn't really have time to read them all. And I would then give lots of, once I'd read them, I'd give them away to other people. So I kind of had my own private library, which was great because the prison's library was pretty awful. I joke in my book that it took me a while to find. I didn't even know we had a library. I found it completely by accident. I was looking for something else. And there's more books in my parents' living room that was in that library in the prison. So, the paucity of literature was pretty awful. But I was okay because people just kept sending them to me.
But, I mean, at one point there was a government policy that books weren't going into prisons.
God, yeah.
Chris Grayling, he's responsible for many of the cuts and many of the deranged sadistic policies that make the prison system what it is today. Yeah, he did at one point try and ban books. But it was actually Lottie's mum, Deborah, and Anthony Horowitz and other writers who made such a colossal fuss about that it was soon overturned. But it gives you a flavour of the mindset of the people who run prisons, that they actually thought that stopping people reading was a good thing to do.
Yeah. So tell us about your book charity then, because you're doing wonderful things with books in prisons.
Yeah, that was kind of really organic. And I didn't sort of mean to do it. I mean, you know, it wasn't sort of planned, but I saw a tweet, as most of these things start. This is during the first lockdown, from Pentonville Prison, saying that the library shut, but what they would do, if people dropped off books at the gates, they would go and hand them out around the wings, because it was even worse than when I was in prison. It was like pretty much 24-hour lockdown during the pandemic. Like any form of education or religion or gym access, exercise, all ground to a halt because of the pandemic. So I said, I called Lottie and her mum and a couple of other people I know in the area and said, look, have you got any spare books? And there's one thing you can say about the Mogok family, they have a lot of spare books. And I basically drove a carload to Pentonville. They were eagerly kind of consumed. And I said, well, let's try and do this to more prisons. And actually, the Ministry of Justice was fantastic. The head of libraries there was brilliant. And he said, I've sent out an email, and here's 50 prisons have emailed back saying, yes, please give us books. So we started calling publishers and literary agents. So my agent, Curtis Brown, and Lottie's agent, Green and Heaton, have been fantastic. Debbie's publisher, Headline. And they all just donate books. They've got cupboards full of books. Publicity copies they've been unable to give out. So I think we're 8,000 books now to 18 prisons, I think we've done. So it's kind of really snowballed. And, hopefully that can, help cheer people in these dark times.
It's called?
Bang Up Books.
Bang Up Books. Fantastic. Yeah. And so how can people get involved? I mean, if they have got books, what should they do?
Well, it's a volume thing, really. So if people have a bag of books, that's not really something we can process because it's not really the books, it's the logistics. I've since become an expert on bloody book logistics. But but yourself, Georgina, you've already given us a couple of carloads. So yeah, if someone's in London and they have a high volume, then we'll come and pick them up. But if they've got a few hundred, we'll send a friend in a car or a van. I've got Lottie's done some driving, my dad, my brother, people I know who are furloughed, who haven't got anything better to do, I sort of twist their arms. So yeah, if people are London-based and they have a good few bags of books, then we'll come and pick them up.
They can find you online, Bang Up Books.
Absolutely, yeah. Just Google Bang Up Books and drop us an email and we'll get in touch.
Yeah, and Lottie, you're clearly still very involved in this too.
Yeah, I'm definitely available for driving and lugging books around. I've already given all, I don't have any spare books left to give, but but yeah, I'm definitely spreading the word.
Both of you, thank you so much. And once again, I just really need to reiterate that I think people should read these books together, although obviously they completely stand up on their own too. They are Lottie Mogok's Brixton Hill, published by Corsair, that's out now, and Chris Atkins' A Bit of a Stretch, The Diaries of a Prisoner, and that's published by Atlantic. Thank you to both of you.
Oh, thank you. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you very much. Thank you.
You've been listening to Meet the Writers. Thanks to the production team of Nora Hull and Charlie Filmer Court. And you can download this show and previous episodes from our website or app, from SoundCloud, Mixcloud, or iTunes. I'm Georgina Godwin. Thank you for listening.